And our first speaker is somebody of whom, if Dr. Samuel Johnson was still alive, he would say, worth seeing, yes, but also worth going to see. We welcome this, and it's a live teleclass, so I'm really pleased that we'll be broadcasting live to the world our teleclass series, the British teleclass series, again hosted by our good friend Paul Weber from Weber Training, and this session is sponsored by Virox Technologies and Johnson Diversey. So it's my pleasure to ask Professor Gary French to come and speak to us. Now, Professor French is Professor of Microbiology at Imperial in London. He is a consultant microbiologist at Guy's and St. Thomas's. He's an ex-chairman of the Hospital Infection Society, ex-editor-in-chief of the Journal of Hospital Infection. His list of achievements, if I were to list them now, he would have no time to speak to us. So we welcome Professor French to come and address us on the subject of 50 years of resistance. Welcome, Gary.
Thank you very much, Martin, and it's a great pleasure indeed to be here, a mixed pleasure being the first speaker. I always remind myself not to speak after Martin, as you know, is a great and entertaining speaker normally, and now I have to add to that your fantastic presentation at the beginning of this opening session of this society. My talk is not so much fun, I'm afraid. It is going to be about antibiotic resistance over 50 years, and it's going to be a model. We often consider modelling these days in terms of identifying infections and how to deal with them. And models are really not the whole truth, but they are ways of understanding what's been going on so that we can take steps to either improve things or at least understand and then go on and improve in the future. So I'm going to be talking about modelling an image of what's been happening with resistance and where we go next. And I'm going to go back actually a bit further than 50 years because antibiotics began a little bit before that, but 50 years more or less. I can't actually see you, the light in my eyes, but I wonder if, can you put your hands up if you've ever had a systemic antibiotic, oral or intravenous, during your life? Fine, I think that's almost everybody. In fact, can anybody who's never had an antibiotic put their hands up? One. What's wrong with you? Two, right, I can see two, three. So almost everybody in this room has had an antibiotic at some time in their lives, and this is really quite unusual for drugs. Antibiotics are quite distinct from all the other drugs that we use. They're the only drugs that are not directed against the patient. They are taken, as you've just demonstrated, by almost everybody at some time in their lives, at least in the Western world, and they have a terrible ecological impact. They're very non-green things. Every treatment upsets the microbial ecology, both of the patient themselves and of the environment around the patient. And at the same time, every treatment begins to start the process of evolution of antimicrobial resistance. So they're quite distinct drugs, and they really come with a rather dangerous background, which we now recognize, but perhaps we should have recognized much earlier. I'm sure you know this picture, Alexander Fleming, who was the discoverer of penicillin. And as I said, we go back a bit further than 50 years because, as I'm sure you know, penicillin was actually, at least the publication, was presented in 1929. A few years after that, in fact, a number of years after that, the use of penicillin as a clinical agent was introduced in 1940, two papers here in 1940 and 1941. So Fleming discovered penicillin, but it wasn't until a little bit later when Chain, Florey, and the others listed here began to use the agent as a treatment of, first of all, mice, and then people. And it's very difficult for us now to take our minds back to that time, because we've lived, all of us, virtually in this room, during the antibiotic era, and we are used to the idea of treating infections. At that time, infections scared people because they would die. The introduction of antibiotics almost overnight as wonder drugs changed that whole picture. Patients who were moribund in the original publications, a child was moribund with infection of the eye and was dying effectively. And with treatment with antibiotics, he, in fact, made a recovery and, alas, then relapsed and died. But nevertheless, the promise of the drugs was shown then, and very soon penicillin was having a dramatic effect on gram-positive infections. But right at the beginning, Fleming, even in 1929, had noted something in which the seeds of destruction were sown. He noted that the penicillin he found was very effective against Streptococcus pyogenes, Staphylococcus aureus, and Streptococcus pneumoniae, and some other streptococci as well. So the penicillin, as we now, of course, recognize still, was active against gram-positive bacteria. But he noted at that time certain interesting facts. It is clear that penicillin contains inhibitory substance, which is very active towards some microbes, while not affecting others. The members of the Coli typhoid group, that's E. coli and Salmonella, of course, are unaffected, as are other intestinal bacilli, such as Bacillus pyosinaeus, which is Pseudomonas aeruginosa. So right at the beginning, he was a brilliant scientist, he observed that penicillin did not treat all microbes equally. So right at the beginning, we discover that some organisms are always sensitive to a particular antibiotic. This is inherent sensitivity, and some are always resistant, so they are inherently resistant. And for example, I mentioned here that syphilis is always sensitive to penicillin still, and Pseudomonas aeruginosa is always resistant to penicillin and ampicillin. But in addition to that, soon after the introduction of penicillin, it was discovered that some sensitive organisms acquired resistance to agents to which they were normally susceptible. And a corollary to that is that antimicrobial resistance is an inevitably evolutionary response to antimicrobial use. And this was known really right from the beginning. And lurking over the whole of this talk and the whole of the last 50 years is Darwin and evolutionary theory. Antimicrobial resistance is a classic example of evolutionary response. What happens when you use an antibiotic is that there is a pressure applied to organisms that results in the emergence of resistance. And there are a number of things that are going on that do this. First of all, there is what I call here a population effect, that antibiotics kill off the sensitive members of a bacterial population, resulting in the more resistant organisms flourishing, and this occurs both within and between species. So if you treat an individual infection with an antibiotic, the population of organisms that are making up that infection tend to be shifted towards the resistant side. And here is a diagram of that. On the left-hand side, there is the distribution of sensitivities of the organisms, with the more sensitive organisms on the left and the more resistant ones on the right. And when you treat with an antibiotic that kills off the sensitive strains, that population is changed so that now more resistant organisms are more common rather than more sensitive ones. And this applies both within a species, so that you get more resistant members of that species surviving, and equally importantly, and certainly in terms of hospital and healthcare infection, more resistant species tend to survive rather than sensitive ones. And this was shown very early on. Look at the date of this paper, 1959. In America, Maxwell Finland, a famous infectious diseases physician in the States, observed even that early that when antibiotics were introduced into his hospital in Boston, first of all sulfonamides in 1937, and then dramatically penicillin in 1945, patients dying in his hospital, he noted that there was a change in the microbial causes of those deaths from effectively gram-positive infections to gram-negative ones. Now, this paper probably would never be published today because there are numerous epidemiological issues that are incorrect in it. But nevertheless, the message is clear there. On the right, you will see that E. coli, Klebsiella, and Proteus were predominant organisms in deaths after the introduction of penicillin. So here we have the example very quickly and very early of penicillin being introduced, the gram-positive infections, which were normally killing patients then, being replaced quickly and dramatically by resistant gram-negative species. So the population effect shifts the populations from sensitive to resistant. Secondly, organisms mutate to resistance. Because bacteria multiply quickly, there is a chance very rapidly of mutations occurring and surviving. not something that happens in humans, but certainly that happens in bacteria. So there is a genetic change to more resistant strains. And in addition, what was called infectious resistance, that very early on also it was discovered that resistance could move from one organism to another. So once an organism had developed the genetic capability of resistance to a particular agent, that resistance could transfer to another bacterium on plasmids and what we now call transposons. And in particular, two dramatic events occurred very early on in the history of this phenomenon. One was that Staph aureus quickly became resistant to penicillin, having dramatically and successfully saved numerous lives soon after 1940. Dramatically and quickly, penicillin began to fail to work. And a little later, E. coli, which was originally resistant to penicillin, of course, but sensitive to ampicillin, E. coli was sensitive to ampicillin naturally, but within a few years became resistant to ampicillin, and now about 60% around the world are resistant to it. So those two figures are quite chilling. 90% of Staph aureus or more are now resistant to penicillin, and 60%, between 40 and 60% of E. coli are now resistant to ampicillin. We all carry E. coli in our guts, so ampicillin resistance has spread around the world to trillions of bacteria, and similarly about 30% of us, as you know, carry Staph aureus, and similarly 90% of those around the world, trillions of organisms, have acquired resistance. This is a worse nightmare in some respects than the spread of HIV. And here we have a diagram of this occurring. On the left-hand side, you see hospital strains of Staph aureus soon became resistant to penicillin, and by 1950, about 50% of hospital strains were resistant to penicillin. By 1960, about 80%, and now about 90 to 95%. And the community strains of Staph aureus followed on behind, rather slowly, but nevertheless reaching, again, 90% resistance by the year 2000. And on the right, E. coli was discovered, or the first ampicillin resistance to E. coli was discovered by Naomi Datta in 1965 in a child who was a Greek girl whose name was Temonera, and she named the enzyme that causes resistance, TEM1, after that little girl. And TEM1, an enzyme on a plasmid, has now spread around the world so that about 40 to 60% of E. coli are now resistant to ampicillin. These are quite chilling pieces of data, that resistance can spread so dramatically. If this were to be true of all our antibiotics, almost nothing now would be workable at all. And it really warns us that this kind of spread internationally can occur at any time. There are a variety of mechanisms of resistance, which I really don't want to spend too much time on today. It doesn't really matter that they occur, but there are a variety of resistance mechanisms that occur in bacteria that can make them resistant to antibiotics. The most important and common is enzyme inactivation, of which resistance to penicillin in Staph aureus by the production of penicillinase, an enzyme which destroys penicillin, and similarly a beta-lactamase, an enzyme that destroys beta-lactam antibiotics in E. coli, are both enzyme inactivation drugs. The organism produces an enzyme which destroys the antibiotic, so the antibiotic can't work. The second common mechanism is that the target sites where the antibiotic bind can alter as a result of genetic mutation. And because they can't bind, the organism is no longer susceptible to the activity of the drug. And the third common mechanism is either an increased resistance to entry of antibiotics or a pump which pumps the antibiotics out. So many antibiotics have to get into the cell and reach a certain concentration before they can have an effect. And if either they can't get in or they're pushed out very quickly, those concentrations don't occur and the organism becomes resistant. The importance, there are other mechanisms as well, but they will do for the time being. The importance of this is that organisms can acquire multiple mechanisms of resistance. And as they acquire these mechanisms, so their level of resistance may increase. And in addition, of course, they may require multiple drug resistance. So by acquiring multiple resistances to a range of antibiotics, they become what we call multi-drug resistant or MDR organisms, and then the situation becomes much more serious. Furthermore, this infectious resistance I mentioned, in which a resistance can be transferred between one organism and another, between a resistant population and a sensitive one, transforming that sensitive population in one step to a resistant population. Furthermore, those resistances can be multiple on the same genetic element, so that multiple resistance can be transferred in one step also. Now, you don't have to read this slide particularly, but these are some of the resistance mechanisms found in Staph aureus. A good medical student test, which you can test on your doctors when you get back to work at the end of the week, is how many classes of antibiotics are active against Staph aureus. Well, I think it's 13, but I've listed 11 here. So there are 11 classes. This is not just different members of the classes, but 13 different kinds of antibiotics are active against Staph aureus, and here are 11 of them. And Staph aureus has mechanisms available to be resistant to all of those. And here are listed here a range of antibiotics and the multiple resistance mechanisms that Staph aureus can accumulate. So this doesn't happen all that often, thank goodness, but it's possible for Staph aureus to become resistant to everything. The pressure pushing antibiotics towards resistance is due to a range of issues around antibiotic use, and it tends to occur in hospitals or healthcare institutions. Firstly, antibiotic use is concentrated in hospitals. More antibiotics are used actually outside in the community than within hospitals, but a greater variety of antibiotics are used in hospitals, and they tend to be used in patients who are susceptible, if you like, to generating resistant strains. Resistance proliferates in the hospital environment because the hospital environment is an antibiotic environment. Infection with resistant organisms, once it starts, fails to respond to normal therapy, and therefore patients become sources of transmission to others since they don't get better quickly. And here we have the first link of antibiotic resistance to hospital healthcare infection. So patients become resistant, they begin to excrete organisms for longer because they're failing therapy, the infections spread, other patients therefore get infected with resistant organisms, and the cycle continues. So hospitals become places where antibiotic resistance is generated. Resistance therefore favours hospital infection, and therefore hospital infection or healthcare associated infection is resistant infection. And indeed, at any one time, the common organisms in a hospital or healthcare environment are resistant to the antibiotics in common use. And a long time ago, I've lost the reference now, but in the 1960s maybe, somebody said that the antibiotic resistance profile of the organisms is a negative image of the antibiotics in use in the hospital. And here we just have a list of some of the common healthcare-associated infections that we're familiar with: Staph aureus and MRSA, enterococci and glycopeptide-resistant enterococci, Klebsiella enterobacter serratia, Pseudomonas aeruginosa, Acinetobacter, and so on. This list of organisms that commonly cause infection in healthcare institutions are a list of antibiotic-resistant and multiply resistant organisms. Some of them are more resistant versions of a common pathogen, and some are new species which have replaced common pathogens because they are inherently resistant. Now, I've used this slide before to say which of these places would you rather sleep in, either the obvious American hospital on the top right or the rather obviously crummy environment on the left. And the answer, of course, always was it's much safer to be on the left-hand side where it may be apparently dirty, but in fact not really very dangerous. And I always used to tell my medical students that it would be safer for them to roll around in the gutter, provided they avoided the traffic in the road outside my hospital in Lambeth Palace Road, than it would be to roll around on the floor in the average ward. But unfortunately, the situation, as is going to happen several times in this talk, is worse than we thought. Because, of course, there is now increasing resistance in the community as well. And of course, this audience doesn't need to be told, that there are no real walls between the hospital, healthcare, and the community environment. So we now have, gradually over time, in the last 50 years, increasing resistance in all these areas. So in the hospital, we have, for example, and these are only some examples, penicillin, methicillin, and ciprofloxacin resistance in Staph aureus. Remember, in 1940, all these resistances I'm mentioning here were almost unknown. Glycopeptide resistant in enterococci, ampicillin, gentamicin, ciprofloxacin, and extended spectrum beta-lactam resistance in E. coli, aminoglycoside and carbapenem resistance in Pseudomonas vaginosa. But also in the community, penicillin resistance now in pneumococcus, and the pneumococcus is now multiply resistant as well, multidrug resistance in Haemophilus, penicillin and methicillin resistance also in Staph aureus, because we are now very well aware that methicillin resistance in Staph aureus is now common, particularly in the States, but has now appeared in Europe and in England also, in Britain also. Glycopeptide resistance in enterococci is now extremely common in Europe as a result of feeding antibiotics to animals. Ampicillin resistance we've already mentioned, but now increasingly extended spectrum beta-lactam resistance in E. coli, an explosion which I'll come back to in just a minute. Ampicillin, ciprofloxacin, and other resistance in Salmonellas, including Salmonella typhi, and multidrug resistance, of course, in tuberculosis, such that some strains of TB now are almost or effectively untreatable. And one last comment on the community, which I won't spend too much time on today. Multidrug resistance in hospitals is bad enough, but in poor countries, small amounts of resistance in community strains may render, in those countries, infections untreatable. The organisms may still be susceptible to some agents, but if they are unaffordable, it effectively means that those infections are untreatable in that area. So resistance in the community is equally important to resistance in hospital and healthcare institutions. And as I said just now, of course, there is no difference between these. And a classic example of that is that community MRSA in the States is now becoming a major cause of nosocomial infection in hospitals once the patients are admitted. So this gradual worldwide appearance of multidrug resistance and what is chillingly called pan-resistance, resistance to everything, is a phenomenon which has gathered a pace, indeed, in the last decade or so. And all this resistance, of course, is associated with antimicrobial use. Now, we can't stop, and we should not stop, using antibiotics, but it is associated with antibiotic abuse. Antibiotics are often used unnecessarily. I'm not going to ask the question of how many of you had antibiotics unnecessarily, but probably quite a lot of us have. And a classic example of this is chloramphenicol. Chloramphenicol is an old-fashioned drug now, but was a very important drug at one point, and is still used, of course. And it was discovered that chloramphenicol in some people produced irreversible aplastic anemia, which is effectively a death sentence. And this was discovered in America quite a number of years ago, simply by looking at cancer patients in the American Cancer Registry, when it was somebody pulled out all the aplastic anemias and went through all the cases individually and discovered that a high number of them have had chloramphenicol. And that was how the link between chloramphenicol and aplastic anemia was discovered. Tragically, it was also noted that in almost every case of those patients who died, the chloramphenicol was unnecessary. It had been given for fever or headache or sore throat, most of which, of course, were viral infections, which would not respond to chloramphenicol anyway. And as we speak, millions of people are now being given antibiotics for either conditions which are not infectious or for infection conditions which will not respond to antibiotics. At the same time as our abuse of antibiotics, there has been a gradual falling in standards of hygienic practice. And again, this now links antibiotic resistance with infection control. Because antibiotics have worked so wonderfully well, tragically, people began to feel that it was no longer necessary to bother about hygiene, because if infections occurred, they could be treated easily. I'll just give you one or two examples of the relationship between antibiotic usage and increasing resistance. Vancomycin was discovered, well, was introduced for use in about the 1950s. And for many decades, there was no resistance to it, largely, I think, because it wasn't used very much. And then because of the emergence of MRSA and the emergence of coagulase negative staphylococcus, often resistant to methicillin, and the emergence of Clostridium difficile, the use of vancomycin dramatically increased, as you can see from this slide, in the mid-80s. So from about 1979 or so, antibiotic vancomycin usage around the world increased dramatically. And then look at that line there in 1988. Guess what? In 1988 and 1999, vancomycin-resistant enterococci appeared spontaneously in the UK, in France, and in the States. Now, this resistance is also a very interesting one, which we haven't got time to go into in detail, but it is located on a plasmid. This is high-level vancomycin resistance, and it consists of about 9 genes in a row, and each of these genes is required to create this resistance, also to encourage the resistance. So it produces the resistance by changing the structure of the cell wall such that vancomycin cannot bind to it. There's a gene for that. And then there are genes which bring in the components required to make this change. And then there are other genes which break down the normal structure of the cell wall so that the abnormal structure is maintained or encouraged. And furthermore, these genes come from different organisms. They're in a row and they come from a range of different organisms, not enterococcal. And this plasmid is all ready to go, manufactured, if you like, by the devil in a special way to make enterococci resistant to vancomycin. How on earth it occurred, goodness only knows. And dramatically, here you see in the United States, starting in 1989, the first emergence of vancomycin-resistant enterococci, and you can see there by 1998, 10 years later, in both intensive care units and the general hospital, enterococcal isolates were more than 20% resistant to vancomycin. And as a rule of thumb, once an organism reaches about 10% resistance, then the effectiveness of treatment becomes dramatically compromised. And in the UK, you see here in the top line, the common vancomycin resistance occurs in Enterococcus faecium, and it's now running at about 20 to 25% of blood culture isolates in the UK as well. Furthermore, this vancomycin resistance gene or set of genes is on a plasmid which can transfer to other organisms, and we've all been extremely worried about it being transferred to Staph aureus because, as you know, vancomycin is the present mainstay of treatment for MRSA serious sepsis. Well, this was transferred by Bill Noble in my own hospital in the laboratory to Enterococcus faecalis so he could do it. I'm not sure he should have done it, but he did it. 10 years later, it took a long time, the first natural strains of fully high-level vancomycin-resistant MRSA began to appear in the States. This has still remained extremely rare, thank goodness, but it just illustrates that this is possible. We don't know why this didn't spread in the same way that penicillin resistance spread amongst Staph aureus, but nevertheless, it is a threat waiting to emerge in the wings. This brings us, of course, to methicillin resistance, which I'm sure you're all heartily sick of by now. But just to remind you that methicillin resistance was extremely rare when methicillin was introduced in 1960. It was present, and interestingly, some of these resistances were present before the antibiotics were actually used clinically. But it was extremely uncommon, and even by 1970, 10 years later, it was only 1% of Staph aureus isolates in the UK. This chart would be very familiar to some of you at least, and that is that around the world, there are now very high rates of methicillin resistance in invasive blood culture isolates of Staph aureus, not just in the UK, but certainly all around Europe, and you will see here levels of as high as 60% of Staph aureus in the blood being resistant to methicillin. This slide also points out, by the way, that there are different rates in different geographical locations, and it's also well known that rates of MRSA are extremely low and remain extremely low in the Scandinavian countries and the Netherlands. And one of the reasons, or perhaps the reason why this is so, is that in those countries they have been particularly careful about antibiotic use. This is certainly true in Denmark, where patients don't like to be given antibiotics, in contrast to this country, where patients not given antibiotics complain to their MP, I think. So there are differences in countries, and this is certainly partly, at least, related to practice. And it also reminds us, and I'll repeat it again, that community MRSA has now emerged. This is an American naval base where young, fit men have now been presenting with community MRSA, which has now replaced hospital types of MRSA. And around the world, I think we're going to see this more and more, that just as penicillin resistance is now the norm in Staph aureus, I think, alas, methicillin resistance will also be the norm, which might at least take some of the pressure off the headlines for us. This chart I showed you slightly before, part of this chart before, the rise in hospital and community penicillin resistance. And now on the right, you see methicillin resistance, hospital and community rising. And you will see the rise there in hospital MRSA, which we're very familiar with, coming from nothing around 1980 to some 40% or 50% of invasive strains by the year 2000. And ominously lagging behind now is community MRSA. And if you look to the left and see the chart for community penicillin resistance, it alas looks very similar, and I suspect that community MRSA will follow the same pattern, so that MRSA will be the normal type of Staph aureus. This is the depressing part of the talk, or the even more depressing part of the talk, if it could be, sorry about this, on Monday morning. Resistance is marching on amongst organisms and their treatable antibiotics or usable antibiotics. And these are charts from UK results, and you just need to look at the patterns, really. Gentamicin resistance, top left in E. coli, bottom right in Klebsiella, rising now in E. coli to reaching some 10% of strains of E. coli and 20% of Klebsiella. Remember, the 10% is probably the cutoff. Ciprofloxacin resistance, again in the same two strains, rising to 23% in E. coli now and about 20% in Klebsiella. And ceftazidime, third-generation cephalosporin resistance, goodness, reaching now 12% or so in E. coli. This is from the blood, and 18 or 19% in Klebsiella. And this emergence of cephalosporin resistance in community strains of E. coli is a dramatic and shocking new change. And just to remind you, again, we could give you charts, I could show you charts of all these organisms around Europe, but it would be a little bit boring. But this is just one to show you the distribution of third-generation resistance in Klebsiella around Europe, and to point out that the purple chart is more than 50% in Greece and some Eastern European countries there. And you can see that this means that these drugs are effectively no longer effective for what is a common and simple infection. This is resistance in England and Wales in Pseudomonas vaginosa, and if you look at the blue line, which is meropenem resistance. Meropenem is the last line for invasive serious gram-negative infections, and you see it's now running at 12% resistance in Pseudomonas. Pseudomonas actually is generally resistant to these drugs by permeability change. So it's multiple resistance by a single mechanism, which is also very chilling. And the same situation is occurring in the US, and here we see multiple resistance in Pseudomonas vaginosa in intensive care units in the US, showing the same pattern of pan-resistance in Pseudomonas for all the major agents that we would normally reach for, reaching something like 30% of resistant strains. So just to summarize what's been going on, and to add in behavioral change. In the 1940s, people were frightened of infection. If you got it, you were going to die, and therefore doctors and nurses spent a lot of time trying to prevent infection. And this fear maintained good practice. Penicillin was introduced magically. We still had patients dying of staph and streptococcal pneumonia and streptococcal skin sepsis and wound infections. The introduction of penicillin magically eliminated that. Gram-negative bacilli, as you saw from the Boston pictures, began to replace those. And very quickly, Staph aureus became penicillin resistant. The drug companies responded by production of methicillin and other penicillin derivatives, and this allowed us to control Staph aureus, which allowed us to have heroic surgery and intensive care, which previously really could not have been managed with staphylococcal sepsis. And that was associated with increasing gram-negative infections, and the drug companies responded with gentamicin and other gram-negative agents. And indeed, they spent a decade really looking for gram-negative therapies. We controlled some of the hospital infections we were seeing in intensive care by the use of disposables and increased hygienic practice around intensive care. And that worked well, but we got multi-resistant or gentamicin-resistant and then multi-resistant gram-negative bacilli. A range of new antibiotics were introduced for the gram-negatives to combat that threat. And we now had a whole row of antibiotic bottles on the shelf. So we treated a patient, they got a resistant staph infection, we treated them with methicillin, we got another infection, which is gram-negative, we treated them with the first gram-negative agent, that became resistant, we reached for another one, and then another one, and then another one, and we began not to care very much about infection. You've got an infection, well, you just give a shot of antibiotics. If that doesn't work, give another antibiotic. There's always plenty more down the shelf. We then got coagulase negative staphylococci associated with plastics, which I won't go into, increasing multi-drug resistant gram-negative bacteria and MRSA. But we really didn't care. This is the 1990s now, beginning of the 1990s. People just didn't give. And also, your wonderful introduction reminded us of all the protest, not protest songs, but a change in behavior. People became more casual. There's a breakdown in formal behavior. People began to sit on beds and chat and smoke and all that sort of stuff. Behavior changed in general, as well as behavior in hospitals as well. And I think there was a dramatic decline in hygienic practice and good medical standards. Vancomycin came in, then there was vancomycin resistance. We began to abuse antibiotics even more. We got into the idea we'd give lots and lots of antibiotics all the time and everything would be fine. And standards continued to decline. And people in this audience know that only too well. And you know, and I know, that standards actually were absolutely dreadful and in certain areas still are. So we got vancomycin-resistant MRSA, multi-drug-resistant gram-negative bacilli. Linezolid, by the way, was introduced, a new antibiotic for the first time in many decades, and resistance to linezolid began to appear even before the drug was licensed. So we've moved from a situation of fear and good behavior to carelessness and bad behavior. And during that period, I think you can see we have squandered the wonder drugs of antibiotics. Antibiotic resistance also has a terrible effect when adjusted for other risks. Mortality, hospitalization, increased length of stay are at least twice as great for patients infected with antibiotic-resistant bacteria as for those infected with susceptible strains of the same species. And hence, antibiotic-resistant infection is expensive infection. Expensive in terms of death and suffering, as well as expensive in terms of cost, in terms of cash. And just this is some examples. MRSA bacteremias have twice the mortality of those caused by methicillin-sensitive Staph aureus, and there are other changes there that you can see. And then just one other example of this, that when you treat an infection, you begin with the best guess antibiotic. What is the infection likely to be? What is the susceptibility which antibiotic is likely to be effective? So you reach for the first antibiotic while sending off the specimens, and then dealing with the patient and waiting for the results. If you don't get it right first time, in seriously ill patients, mortality rates go up. And if you are getting increasing antibiotic resistance, which you don't quite recognize, you'll get it wrong and patients will die. And these are just some striking results with what is called inadequate therapy. Inadequate therapy is when you give the wrong antibiotic at first, and you see the mortality rates here quite dramatically different in a series of papers on bloodstream infections. This was recognized, this whole problem was recognized quite a long time ago, and there were some very important papers by some very important people, as you see here in 1992, Harold New, wrote a paper called The Crisis in Antibiotic Resistance in Science. Calvin Kunin wrote a paper, Resistance to Antimicrobial Drugs, a Worldwide Calamity, in 1993. And Cohen wrote a paper called The Epidemiology of Drug Resistance, Implications for a Post-Antibiotic Era. They were saying that the antibiotic era had come to an end. And it was only a blink of an eyelid for the bacteria themselves, who've been around for millennia. This is less than a nanosecond of time. We wasted antibiotics like that. That was in 1992. By 2004, the American IDSA wrote a paper called Bad Bugs, No Drugs, because the situation, once again, ladies and gentlemen, is worse than I've just said. Because not only is there all this resistance around, but also we have no more new antibiotics. And there's a series of papers here describing that. This Time magazine cover is 1994. So people have recognized this for quite a long time, but nothing happened. And this is just to show that antibiotics have come to an end. There are all sorts of reasons for this, which I haven't got time to go into now. But you can see that all those antibiotics on the left were introduced rapidly. When the last new one was around 1970, now 40 years ago, two new classes of antibiotics have been introduced. 1999, the oxazolidinones in the form of linezolid, and in 2003, the lipoglycopeptides in terms of daptomycin. And there's also been tigecycline in 2008. But almost all the new antibiotics that have been introduced during this 40-year period have been new versions of old drugs. So we haven't even got new classes of antibiotics. And in general, when an organism is resistant to one member of a class, it's going to be resistant to all members of the class. Antibiotics are expensive to produce. By the time you've gone through the 20-year development, maybe they're no longer wanted because they no longer work. And as I mentioned just now, linezolid, when it was introduced, resistance had emerged even before the drug was licensed. So antibiotics are not good agents for drug companies to make money with. And they're much more likely to go for a diabetic drug or a fat drug or a cholesterol drug, which is going to be used in lots of people and is not going to be out of action within just a few years. So I've spent most of this talk talking about how dreadful the situation is. I've got about 5 minutes to tell you what we're going to do about it to reverse 50 years of disaster, incompetence, ignorance, stupidity, carelessness in 5 minutes. Well, I mean, obviously not in 5 minutes, but what can we do about it? Well, the answer is actually extremely simple and it's extremely simple and will be very familiar to you. The first, and these are two intertwined actions. There are other actions as well. We can have new ways of treating infections, and I won't go into that today. I think that's going to be difficult, although I think vaccines may offer major hope in the future. But for the moment, we have to deal with what we have. And we have two things we have to do, which, as I said, are intertwined. Firstly, the control of antimicrobial use, which is properly called these days antibiotic stewardship. We need to treat patients with appropriate antibiotics promptly based upon surveillance, based upon a knowledge of organisms and their resistance patterns. We need to start with serious therapy for seriously ill patients. We need to not use antibiotics for patients who are not infected or not seriously ill. And we need to step down from high-level drugs to lower-level drugs if we can. We need to reduce or eliminate all unnecessary antibiotic usage. At any one time in our hospitals, about a third of patients are being given antibiotics. At any one time, probably about half of those don't need those antibiotics. So we need to control antibiotic usage very strictly. We need to give antibiotics only for the length of time that they're needed, which is usually only a few days and not several weeks. And we need to give only those antibiotics that are going to work. And of course, part of this centers around education, provision of guidance, monitoring behavior, and ensuring delivery to those targets. Now, this must be very familiar to you, sounding very familiar to you as an infection control nursing group. And in addition, we have to control, I'm sorry I keep using the word hospital, I'm over 50 years old myself, so healthcare infection as well as hospital infection. We need to control infection. I haven't gone into it in great detail now, but a great deal of the spread of antimicrobial, or the increase in antimicrobial resistance in hospitals, is due to the spread of hospital infection and not just antibiotic usage per se, although antibiotic usage also encourages, of course, hospital spread. So we need to do both these things, and as you will be very familiar with, education, guidance, monitoring, delivery, and strictness is a thing that's going to deliver on both these targets. I go back to my first slide. Antibiotics are different. Every treatment upsets antimicrobial ecology and is associated with an inevitable rise in resistance. I will go back finally to one or two quotes from the past again. 1983, John McGowan said about antibiotic usage and resistance. 1983, this is 30 years ago. Consensus rarely exists on topics in infectious diseases, yet authors of virtually all the papers reviewed in his paper, this is in 1983, there were 68 references, agree on the need for careful discriminating use of antibiotics as being the keystone of our attempts to control resistant bacteria in the hospital, and we can add to that healthcare institutions and the community. And finally, I think a very important comment in 1997 from the British Standing Medical Advisory Committee. They say a prescription of an antibiotic should be seen as a serious step, similar to the prescription of steroids or any other potentially hazardous medication. Junior doctors are taught, don't give steroids unless you have to. When you give it, start thinking about when you're going to stop it, because they're dangerous. They don't get told that properly, or they don't understand it, about antibiotics. And here is really the center of what we're talking about, a wonderful paragraph to my mind. We should regard antimicrobial agents as a valuable and non-renewable resource to be treasured and protected in their own and everybody else's interest. How many people treasure antibiotics? How many doctors and nurses treasure antibiotics? Not many, I think. We should do. This is a green issue as well. We're wasting resources and we're polluting and changing the environment. We should regard antibiotics as a non-renewable resource and use them properly. So a depressing talk, I'm afraid, for a Monday morning after such a wonderful introduction on this conference. But there is one little bit of light at the end of the tunnel, I think. You will be very familiar with the fact that in the UK we have dramatically reduced MRSA bacteremias by, on this table here, from the British figures, 40% in 7 years. Now that still is not good enough because we still have 4,500 MRSA bacteremias every year, which is, as you know, 40,000 serious infections and 400,000 transmissions at least, all of which, or 90% of which, probably are avoidable. So we've still got a long way to go. But what this slide tells us, which you are very familiar with, is that we have had a change of culture. There has been a change of heart. People are behaving differently. And we have to do the same thing now with antibiotic usage as we have done, or we are doing, or we're beginning to do, with hospital and healthcare-associated infections. Thank you.